Welcome to Conversations of the Strange.
Conversations of the Strange.
And welcome to another episode of Conversations of the Strange. I am Don Everett Smith Jr. I'm your host. And I am on the phone with a wonderful writer, Jody McDaniel Lowry. She is a very gifted writer who has written three books, Eula, Jr., and Jan. And we're going to talk with her today about her book, Jan. Jan is the story of Janice Buttram. She is the youngest person ever sentenced to the electric chair. And this was in 1981. She and her husband were arrested for the murder of Demetra Parker. And we're going to talk with Jody today about the murder and what occurred, and we're going to talk with Jody about the process of writing the book, because Jody actually spent 40 hours talking with Jan and to do the research. And I've got to tell you, I've had a chance to read through the book. It is an absolutely excellent book. And if you are a true crime writer, and also everybody is talking about supporting the independent supporting local businesses and independent writers. Jody is an independent writer. She marches to the beat of her own drum. And I got to tell you, it seems like people are liking the tune, and she is playing the tune very well, if we can continue with the drum marching metaphor. And I got to say, Jody, wonderful book. Thank you so much for being on today.
Well, thank you, Don, for having me. I really appreciate the support of being a local writer and an independent writer.
Gotcha. One of the great things about being an independent writer is that you get to choose what you want to write. So if you decide tomorrow that you want to write about elephants on the Serengeti, you can write about elephants on the Serengeti. Or if tomorrow you want to write about another murder, you can write about another murder. Or if you find potting houseplants interesting, you can do whatever you want to. You can, thanks to the internet and thanks to modern publishers such as Outskirts Press, which I had a chance to go through their catalog, and they've got some amazing books there, such as yours. And I believe that they published all three of your books. Am I correct?
They did. Yes, they're very easy to work with, and it's a very simple process.
Gotcha. That's amazing. And I'm going to put you on the spot, and this was something I did not warn you about beforehand, but I'm going to demand it, and I'm going to put you on the spot for all of America to hear. You're going to have to come back and talk about Junior and Eula on two different occasions. Can I hold you to that?
That would be perfectly fine. Yes, I would love to.
Nice, because I got to tell you, I have not had a chance to read Junior or Eula, but if they're anywhere as good as Jan is, I look forward to reading them.
Well, thank you.
So, all right, let's go ahead. Enough with the fun stuff. Unfortunately, we've got to turn this into a very serious discussion, and a rather informative one as well. Can we talk a little bit about the crime itself?
Sure.
Would that be okay?
That'll be fine.
Okay. All right. Janice Buttram was 15 years old when she married her 26-year-old husband. Am I correct?
That is
on that?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And the murder, and this occurred, she probably married her husband late 1970s, like 78, 79,
yes.
Right?
And they okay. And had a child shortly thereafter. So.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. So she then ends up going to this she and her husband are living in this hotel called the Country Boy Inn down in Dalton, Georgia. And a woman by the name of Demetra Parker is also living in this hotel. And this is not just your – would you say that this hotel is the type of hotel that, like, you know, truckers stop at for the night? Like, this is not something that you'd be going on your family vacation to. Like, oh, let's go to Dalton and we hang out at the Holiday Inn. This is, like, kind of like a fly-by-night – I hate to use the phrase a no-tell motel. So you can, like, rent for the week. Am I correct?
You can rent for the week, and it was a very interesting place. I had a – a friend that actually lived there right about the same time, and she said there was just a very negative aura across the whole place. You know, she said I couldn't tell you what it was. She said there was a lot of drinking, a lot of, you know, illegal drugs and things. And she said finally I just had to tell my parents I need to get out of here and go someplace else. So yeah.
Oh wow, gotcha. And Janice and Danny, Danny, that was her husband's name, right? Danny Bertram, right?
Yes.
Okay. Janice and Danny, more or less, they had struck up a relationship, and I don't mean like a romantic relationship. They struck up like they were on speaking terms with her, like they knew who she was. She was like, she lived a couple of hotel rooms down, and more or less, it seemed like, for everything I've read, it seems like Janice went down there to bum cigarettes off of Demetra at 4 a.m, and it either happened once or twice, and then Danny forced himself into the room, and then Danny was basically sexually assaulting her. Janice came running in and stabbed her with a pocket knife, and within a few minutes, she was like, she was dead, or like she had been stabbed at least 91 times. I've seen some people say 90. I've seen other accounts say 97. And at the same time, he was sexually assaulting her. Danny was sexually assaulting Demetra. And then at the end of it, he rammed something up Demetra's lower areas, if you catch what I'm saying. And left her for dead, and then it was the owner of the hotel, I believe his name was Mr. Patel, am I correct on that?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, Mr. Patel came in, found it, and then called the police, and Danny and Janice, and they had a daughter at the same time, drove down to Florida. They were trying to start a new life in Pensacola, of all places, and more or less, they eventually got caught for this. They were tried for it. They were both sentenced, found guilty, and sentenced to the electric chair.
Actually, they were both sentenced just to death. It wasn't the electric chair at the time, just to death.
Okay, they were both sentenced to death. And Danny, a few weeks after this, hung himself in his jail cell. Am I correct?
Yes, and most of the time when people say he hung himself, they put the parentheses in the air around hung, because there was a lot of interesting talk about was it a suicide or was it an assisted end of life.
Gotcha. Cough, cough, Jeffrey Epstein.
Yes.
Cough, cough.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Can I be so bold to say is no real loss there?
No real loss at all. I think he was just scum is not the right word, but that was the closest word you could probably come up with.
Gotcha. Okay. So with all of that going on, she is sentenced to death, and she's about 18 years old when all of this happened.
Yeah.
Was she pregnant at the time that the murder occurred? I know she had one daughter. Was she also pregnant at the time the murder occurred?
She was pregnant. Her oldest daughter was 19 months old, and they actually brought her into the room that night when the murder was being committed. Janice actually handed her the phone to play with, because back then we still had rotary phones. So,
right.
Yeah.
Lovely. Very lovely. Yeah. And, yeah. So with all of this happening, it's just awful. Now, let me take it back a little bit. What type of town is Dalton, Georgia? Is Dalton, Georgia kind of like a truck stop town? Is this a, like, are we talking like a busy type of town? Like, is there like a town that you can compare Dalton to? Like, we're obviously not talking something like New York City. Are we talking like a lower version of, say, like Reno, Nevada, or kind of like a less hospitable version of Joplin, Missouri, or something like that?
Actually, Dalton is a very industry-driven town. It's known as the carpet capital of the world. We actually produce 90% of the world's carpet. at the time. Now it's geared more towards, you know, the flooring industry. But it's always been a textile town. And it's,
gotcha.
And it's rather large, but this was more of the south end of the county, Whitfield County, so it wasn't in the downtown area. It was more of just a blip off the interstate.
Gotcha. Like, this would be the place to go when the kids in the kids heading to Florida are screaming, "Dad, if we don't go to the bathroom now, we're going to wet the car."
Yeah.
It's fine. I'll pull into Dalton and see what I can find.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Gotcha. And let's talk a little bit about Janice's background. You go into very great detail about Janice's background, about she did not have the easiest background. In fact, it's almost stereotypical when you hear about cases like this of the type of background she had. And like bullying, broken home, alcoholism was a part of this. Can you go into a little bit about what her home life was like, very briefly?
Actually, her mother was a prostitute. She did not know her father at all. Her mother actually sold her to a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Adcock, and they basically paid her hospital bill, and that was the transaction. And they took Janice home with them. They never formally adopted her. They never went through the proper channels. And Mrs. Adcock actually held that over Janice's head quite a bit. It was more like, "Well, I paid for you, so I can treat you the way I want to a certain degree."
Oh.
Yeah. And what?
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. And her father passed away right in her preteen years, and so that left her to butt heads with her mother. And so she ended up going into the foster care system for 2 or 3 years, and she was bounced from place to place to place. And part of it was just the acting out, and part of it was just being at that age where it's hard to find homes for, you know, children at that stage in life, because everybody wants babies. So here she was, 12 and 13 and 14 years old, trying to find a place to fit in. But her life was never great. The Adcocks, people talked about that the Adcocks went to the county dump and dug through trash, pulling clothes out. So she was always she was always teased in school for smelling and not being clean, and so there was always that taunting of, you know, not looking like everyone else. So that made it difficult too.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about, you've got one really interesting story about in your book about what her home life was like when I think it was Mrs. Adcock had to go away for the summer because of a medical procedure or something. Can you talk about that neighbor that Janice had to stay with?
The neighbor was actually her aunt, I believe is what it was, that she took her in for the summertime, and in order to sort of help with the cleaning, you know, and not say to her, "You're a dirty child," she would talk about taking the kids down to the creek to play. And she said, "I would take a towel and a bar of soap with me," and sort of incorporate washing her hair and getting her a little cleaner when she was there. And Janice never really understood why her mother was sent away. It was never really explained. So I don't know if she had health problems or if it was a breakdown of sorts. There was always a lot of gray areas to what exactly was wrong with her.
Right. Well, one of the other things that I was reading in there was that, is this the same neighbor that gave her water and a hot dog for one meal a day or something like that?
No, that is a next door neighbor. Her father actually had to find some, you know, daycare. I mean, here he was trying to raise a child by himself and a girl on top of that. And he left her with a neighbor, and the neighbor was not feeding her well. And so Janice came home, you know, telling her father what had happened, and I think it went on not very long. And Daddy pretty much snatched her up and told the neighbor off and brought her home and fed her a good meal. I think she talked about that night, what they had had for supper. But,
right, yeah, I remember it was like beef stew, and she went into great detail about it, So... Oh, man. And so then eventually at some point in time, she ends up meeting, like, how did she end up, like, well, I'm sorry, let me go back. As she's gotten older, she's it sounds like you can almost write the script yourself. She's doesn't do well in school. The other kids that are doing slightly better financially, study wise, are looking at her as like basically the screw up biker chick that's basically going to be literally pregnant before the age of 19, and she keeps getting into trouble, all kinds of things like that. And she eventually, at the age of 15, she meets Danny.
Right.
How did the two of them meet?
Well, actually, just prior to that, she talks about trying to find a way to escape her hometown. And she actually asks a friend to drive her to Atlanta. And her solution is she is going to turn herself into a prostitute just to find a way out of town. And she explains that in this little adventure, that this so-called friend and a buddy of his actually rape her. So it's become difficult even then. But she met Danny, on a weekend through just a family friend. They happened to be out together with her and her mother, and by the end of the day, they were supposedly in love with each other. I think he was just her ticket out of town, is almost the way she saw him. Because he showed her attention. He actually proposed to her less than a week after they were together. And I think he had his own agenda for doing that, because he did not have a great history himself.
Right. And I was going to ask you very briefly, can you talk about his history?
Sure. He had actually been married one time before Janice, and he was abusive to that wife. He had been in and out of jail numerous times. He had already been in a mental institution a little bit before he met Janice. His mother actually had him committed. And even then, he was having sexual fantasies. He talked about to the psychiatrist that he had visions then of raping a woman.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he was not a normal, clean-cut American boy either.
Right. Were you able to get like any sort of background on the type of person that he was? Like, are we talking somebody that... like, obviously, he's not a book reader, and I hate to say it that way, but would you say that he could read a situation and know how to manipulate his way around it?
I think people would probably say he went to the School of Hard Knocks. He was not
okay.
a typical school kid. You know, he dropped out of school. He got his education by the streets and learning how to con people, and I think that's what happened with Janice, that he saw this as somebody else he could take advantage of very quickly.
Right, right. And Janice, obviously, like, more or less, it seems like he was a bit of a father figure to her, and she was in need of a father figure at this point in time.
I think so. I think it was just one of those things. It happened to be the right place at the right time for both of them.
Gotcha. Now, at the same time, both of them were on parole when they got together. What was Janice on parole for?
She was on probation just for some petty things. I mean, I think shoplifting and a couple of things like that. Nothing to the extent he had been. He had stolen cars. He had had some battery episodes of beating people up. And so their crimes were totally different at that point. And she happened to have a probation officer, and he had a probation officer. And they were actually told to stay away from each other. And
oh, really?
They couldn't heed the advice. Okay. The probation officer actually gave them a choice that Danny could either go back to jail or they could quit seeing each other.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. And then ultimately they got married, right?
They did.
Yeah. And I guess this was an excuse, because then Janice's mom was able to sign off on it and everything, right?
She was, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let me go back real quick and just talk about Janice's mom, and by mom I say Mrs. Adcock.
Right.
It was like 9 weeks after Mr. Adcock died, didn't she bring home another guy, Franklin something or other? It was like Pierce or something?
Yes, she was, her and Mr. Adcock both were drinkers. I think her more so than the husband was, because Mr. Adcock actually had a job with the DOT and had a 40-hour week job, and his drinking was more or less on the weekends of you know, decompressing from the job and then getting start the whole routine again. And I think hers was, it was her way of coping with what was going on in her life. And once Mr. Adcock died, that accelerated. Plus, it accelerated the company she kept. And that gentleman actually,
okay.
that gentleman actually came in and made advances towards Janice.
Yeah, I was reading about that, where at one point he tries kissing her, and she makes a big fuss over it, and he's like, get away, get away, get away, and he just went, this is not over, or
right.
something like, he whispers, this isn't over, or I'll remember this, or something like that,
yeah.
So, wow, just real nice. Now, before, after she met Danny and everything, had she had a history of violent tendencies?
No, she had acted out some. There were some occasions. There was actually a childhood incident that was sort of gave an indication she could turn in a different way very quickly. And it was a young girl that they actually were at a laundromat together. And the young girl said something about Janice's mother. I mean, you know, that's typically what children do, is teasing someone about something else. And Janice
right.
literally knocked the little girl to the ground and started hitting her head on the ground. And it was a constant
right.
pad. So, I mean, you knew then that there could be a tendency towards something worse if something else didn't change before then.
Right, right. And so she and Danny get married. And what year was this? About 1979, 1978?
Yeah, 1979. Late 78, early 79.
Okay. And they ended up in 1981... at the country. Was it 81 that the Demetra Parker happened?
It was actually Labor Day weekend of 1980, because
okay,
Janice,
gotcha.
Janice talked about that they had watched the Jerry Lewis telethon. You know, back then that was a big thing of when those things were of raising money. And
right.
the murder happened, I think, that Monday night into the Tuesday, or Tuesday into Wednesday. It was one of those things that was right there at that Labor Day weekend.
Wow. So, like, was... So, like, the murder, how long was the whole period where all this occurred?
Probably about a week's time. Not very much. From what I have read, Demetra was attracted to their daughter more than she was to them. She was somebody that, you know, loved children, and, of course, their child was somebody, I'm sure, that was craving affection. I'm sure her life was
right.
not great even then. And so she was typically reaching out and talking to the little girl, and had actually watched the little girl, I think, at some point, maybe, you know, for a couple of hours for them. And she had also done things like showed them what stores to go to and where to go to do their laundry and those kind of things. So she was trying to be hospitable to them, not knowing who she was being hospitable to.
Right, right. And when this all happened, and it was like within about a week of meeting, but let me go back. The night before the murder, she was watching, Demetra Parker was watching TV with a couple of her friends, and the door was open to their motel, right now they're in the Country Boy Inn,
right.
And Danny Buttram walks past the hotel about 15-20 times, walks past that room and just kind of looks in at it, and she's like, all right, you know what, I'm getting creeped out, can you guys close the door? And so they close the door, and then they're watching TV, and then after they leave, she goes to her boyfriend's till about midnight, comes back to her hotel room, falls asleep, and then it was about 4 a.m. That morning when Janice knocks on the door and says, Danny needs cigarettes.
Now, you have to take into consideration, this is what the old kind of hotels where your room walked out
right.
to a balcony, so the doors were open to the outside. So it was
right.
very easy for him to walk that ledge going back and forth, just sort of, you know, make her ill at ease. But they had
not to be...
I'm sorry.
If I may interrupt, I'm going to go in a very weird way with this. You can almost compare it to, it looks like the motel in the Bates Motel, if you've ever seen the
yes.
movie Psycho.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, people even described it that these long-termers even had rooms on the back that sort of face the highway. So you got that sound of, you know, muffled sounds from the highways. You're not going to be able to hear what's going on around you. They were known to sit out on their porches with each other and drink at night and, you know, hang out at night. It was just
right.
That kind of place.
Right. And one of the other things, if I can bring this up, it had said that Danny and Janice were involved with threesomes. Now, I'm assuming that this is what based on what I would read about Danny, he's basically bringing a third girl into the bedroom. I kept reading in your book, because you actually have get into a pretty lengthy discussion about Janice's sexuality. And there was actually questions whether Janice was attracted to Demetra or something like that. But before all this occurred, it seemed that one of the reasons why there was such a dislike toward Demetra was she was invited in to be part of their threesome, and she refused, and that kind of set Danny off. Or am I, like, that? That's what it seemed like I had been reading in some of the other sources.
That night they were out riding around, Danny and Janice were, and he stopped at two other coworkers' houses trying to pick them up to get them to come with them, and they felt very eerie or very scared and put him off. One woman was at home by herself, and she basically shut the door and locked it. At the second home they stopped at, the coworker's boyfriend happened to be there and run him off. So he had been turned down two or three times by that point. So I'm sure there was a lot of sexual frustration and, you know, means to an end. And when he came back to the hotel, they didn't really interact. I think he just took it upon himself that he says, you know, she's just like all the others. She's rebuked him, too, that she didn't want to be with him. And I don't know if he took it as she thought she was better than him or what, but it seemed to be the atmosphere of I'll show her.
Right, so it's a classic case. Right, so to put it in a very weird way, it's sort of like the father has gotten yelled at work by his boss, and he can't say anything to his boss, or else he'll get fired. So when he comes home, he takes his frustration out on the kids.
Yeah.
So it seems like there's a level of that. So he probably thought Demetra was really pretty beforehand, and just assumed that Demetra would turn him down the way that these other people did, and he probably was not happy about that whole pacing back and forth. And then when the door closed, he probably goes, okay, that's just one more rejection then.
Yeah, and he actually sent Janice to her door twice that night, because he sent her down one time for cigarettes, and Demetra gave her cigarettes and sent her back off. Well, I don't know that Janice understood what she was actually being sent to do, whether it was just to see if there was a reaction or what. And he sent her back a second time, and this time it was for matches. And she says when Demetra came to the door, she said, I gave her a kiss or a hug, almost like that Judas moment of, you know, betrayal.
Right.
And she said, she claims she didn't know Danny was behind her. And that he basically reached around and pushed the door open and pushed Janice out of the room and shut the door. So he was basically using her as a ploy to get to that point.
Gotcha. So when Danny came in, he throws Demetra to the ground and more or less starts sexually assaulting her. And then Janice decides to open up the door and come in. She gives her daughter the phone, lets the daughter play with it. Janice sees the pocket knife, and that's when she basically does the first stab. Is that confirmed?
Yes. Actually, when she was pushed out on the balcony, she heard her daughter cry out because Danny had left her in the room by herself. And she said, I went to pick up my daughter, and I came back, and she said, I stood outside that door for just a little bit trying to decide what should I do. You know, can I run off? Can I escape what's about to happen? And she said, I didn't have a car. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a way of doing anything. And she said, so I made that choice to walk in. And she claims the way the room was set up, she couldn't immediately see what was happening. She basically just set the child down, and as she came around the corner of the bed, she realized what was happening. So I don't know if it was an act of jealousy, whether it was an act of, I'm just going to participate because he is, it's hard to tell, but she was the one that struck the first blow.
Right, and she didn't give any indication as to what it was, or it was kind of like, you know what?
Yeah.
Because, like, how do you go from, I'm watching my husband rape this woman, to, I think I'm going to stab her?
Yeah.
That boggles my mind, like, how you jump from that to that.
And I'm not sure there wasn't a little bit of underlying jealousy, because Demetra was a very attractive lady, and she was a very slim, you know, petite, well-proportioned lady, and Janice was a little frumpy, and I say that in, you know, as a way of description of, she was, you know, 4'11" and a little overweight, and I said, I don't know if there was a little bit of jealousy there that here my husband is paying attention to someone else and not me, or what, but.
Right, right. And yeah, and then it just goes from there. How long did the whole event occur from the time where Danny walked in to when they walked out, leaving the body on the ground?
Probably 45 minutes to an hour. Nobody really knows for sure. I know that one of the lady whose room backed up to Demetra's talked about hearing a scream, but she didn't report it. So there was, you know, it's hard to say exactly how long it is, because you don't know if the sound was being muffled by the, you know, other outside noises, or whether people were just choosing to ignore what was happening.
Right. Gotcha. And while all of this was happening, she like again, just, I'm imagining that, like, Janice is in just like a fit. You know what I mean? It's not just like, oh, I'm going to stab here, I'm going to stab here, I'm going to, like if you've ever seen Murder on the Orient Express, when everybody at the same time goes into that guy's room. Here, I'm ruining it for you. Spoilers. It's like, okay, I hate this guy because he did this to me. Here's the knife to the next person. I hate this guy because he did this to my girlfriend. Here, give the knife to the next person. We're talking now, Janice is basically coming in and just like, stab, 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 stab at this point. Am I correct on that?
Most of the wounds were to the chest area near the heart, so she knew what she was hitting for. But probably the worst gash was the very last one, because they literally gashed her across her abdomen. And so
Danny that did that? Was that Danny that did that, or was that Janice that did that last gash?
I think they both have admitted to it, so it's hard to say who did it. It's one of those things, you know, they both admitted to it, and I don't know if it was she admitted to it hoping to take the blame off of him, or one just wanted bragging rights. Because it's never been actually clear who did it.
Right, right. Okay. Oof. Just the whole thing was pretty awful. All right. Let's jump to when they get captured. What was it that tipped them off? Was it just a case of, hey, wait, like, why did people think that it was Janice and Danny that killed her? Because it's not like you had fingerprints and go, oh, that's Janice's fingerprints, we can match it up. It wasn't like you had any of those databases in at that time. Or if you did, you just happened to be very lucky with that.
Actually, what had happened was they stole Demetra's car. And when they left the motel, they weren't scheduled to check out for a couple of more days. And she said that they basically tossed the keys and left. You know, and so they were able to tie the fact that here this couple's key was here and they weren't, and Demetra's car was gone. So that was sort of their moment of, well, this must be who it is. But the interesting thing was, is it was actually his mother that turned against him.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and she had been his cheerleader all the way through. I mean, she was the one that became a bail bondsman so she could bail him out of jail. And I mean, he was a mother's boy from the get-go, and the GBI actually convinced her to, when they went to wire, she went to wire money to him, that she told them where they were.
Gotcha. Now, GBI is the Georgia Bureau of Investigations.
Yes.
Which, I gotta say on a side note, that's just a really cool name. It really is.
Yeah, it is, and I've actually talked to the GBI agent who transported them from Florida back to Dalton. It's one of those things that it seems that after the book comes out, I still run into people that have a connection to it. And that was the case with this gentleman, is I actually was conducting a writer's workshop, and he was one of the people in the class. And he says, oh, by the way, you know, I was the one that transported them that night. And it was interesting
to
me that they had them in the same car with each other. You know, here they were both sitting in the back seat together, and she was a typical teenager. She was trying to carry on conversations and, you know, this, that, and the other, and Danny's sitting there with a scowl on his face going, you know, can you quit talking?
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah, because you can imagine that. There's this almost level of, my wife and I have been watching The Middle TV series with Neil Flynn and Patricia Heaton, and they've got a daughter, Sue Heck, who's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. This is so exciting. Can't believe it. And just, you've got somebody like that in the back seat after a murder. Wow, can you believe this? Well, I love how we're traveling. So where are we going to go? What's going to happen? And it's like, miss, you just committed a murder. Please shut up. So it's just,
and, wow. And it was that way when they interviewed her the first time. It was the two different interviews were drastically different. With hers, it was a much longer interview, and she just took it and ran with it. I mean, they didn't even have to Mirandize her. She just says, oh, I've heard that on TV. I know it. You don't have to read it to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, she should have taken advice of counsel, but there was no counsel around.
Right. So when they finally do go to trial for it, both of them have the same lawyer. Am I correct? Like, they're both on trial at the exact same time.
Actually, he was tried first because a local OBGYN doctor decided that it would be too stressful for her to be tried first, being pregnant. And I think that really hurt them, because most of the time they're more sympathetic to a woman than they are a man. And unfortunately, by trying him first, the public had already been exposed to all these gory details and all these things that had happened, and then her trial comes along. So.
Right. And that allowed, and because of that, she was then, both of them were sentenced to be executed.
Yeah.
Now, this is the thing that kind of blows my mind. Everybody, because you had said before our interview that everybody that was involved in the prosecution and the capture all said that Janice was the mastermind of this. Forgive me. How is that possible? I mean, unless she said to Danny, if you don't help me kill Demetra, I will never do X, Y, and Z for you, or I will deny you this, or I will make sure somebody else hurts you. How did anybody think that she was not involved? Like, how did anybody think that she was the one that started this? Because at the very least, if Danny didn't want to kill her, he at least wanted to sexually assault her or something, and he was going to go rape her. Like if Janice hadn't been there, do you think the turnout would have been different? Do you think it would have been to come in, he rapes her, and then walks away from the situation, leaving her alone? Or do you think it was always their intent for the both of them? Or do you think the intent was Janice just kind of in a fury of emotion kills Demetra and starts stabbing her, and then he's like, basically, well, might as well finish what's been started type of thing? Any idea on how that possibly played out?
Well, when I talked to the different participants, they were all, their impression was that she was very manipulative, Janice was, and that Danny's IQ level was probably, you know, borderline of not mental retardation, but he was very low on the IQ level, and that he could be very easily manipulated. But I sort of found that hard to believe, that they were both in situations where they'd learned to sort of con people around them. And I know that one of the judge actually said, you know, had he acted alone, it might not have ever happened. And if she had acted alone, it might not have ever happened. He said, but when you put the two together, he said it was literally like a perfect storm that they fed off each other.
Mm. Gotcha.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, when they were both sentenced to die, they were both sentenced to be executed, Danny again commits suicide or dies in a cell. Let me put it that way. Yeah. He dies in a cell.
He actually had a reason for that. Janice did. She said he had tried to commit suicide once before in the county jail. he had taken, I don't know if you remember, Big Pens used to have the little clear cylinder barrels. And
oh, yeah.
Then they had the, you know, little colored tip on them for the lid. Well, he had actually broken one of those and tried to cut his wrist, you know. And so they took him to the doctor and bandaged him up. And she said this time he had told the chaplain had been around to see him, and the chaplain offered to buy him cigarettes, because back then they could smoke in their cells, and there was vending machines in the lobby where they could buy cigarettes. And so the chaplain was going to go purchase cigarettes for him, and he happened to be in the lobby, and they brought a drunken disorderly in. Well, he was also an officer, a deputy, so he had to help defuse that situation. And by the time he got back, Danny had hung himself. And I think it was probably one of those things that he thought, Danny thought he might be rescued. You know, that he would hang himself, and then the chaplain would get there in the nick of time to cut him down again. And it would go more towards that insanity kind of defense of, you know.
Gotcha. So basically, he more or less kind of was like, his last probably thoughts were, wait, he's not coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Type of thing. Okay. Going back to the murder, it is confirmed that Janice, how many months pregnant was she when she stabbed Dimitri?
I want to say a couple of months pregnant, because this was September, and I want to say they tried her the next August, maybe. So she wasn't very far along, maybe just a couple of months.
Okay. Now, my reason for asking is, do you think that pregnancy hormones could have played a part in any of this? Just the other day, I was watching a TV show where they were joking about the woman. She was being pregnant, and she went from, like, very sexually aroused to very opinionated to, like, within about a five-minute period, she was, like, she accidentally, like, gets angry and she punches her husband, and then she's like, oh, I'm so sorry, let me kiss it and make it feel better. She starts kissing her husband, and she's like, oh, sweetie, come here, let's go back into the bedroom and I'll really make this right. And then she passes a picture of her mother, and her mother and she starts crying. She's like, my mom will never see our baby because she passed away a few years. Like, do you think that any of that could have played a part in it?
Hard to say, because I you know, it could be that partly her age played a key into it too. I mean, she was a teenager, she was hormonal, and then she's pregnant on top of that. She's got a baby already, and you know, I can imagine that it wasn't a pleasant life to be in. So there's gonna be a lot of factors that just tilted it over the edge, you know.
Right. And then Because that's why I actually had that in my notes. I was like, could pregnancy hormones have played a part in this? And I don't mean that in a,
because
some people will do that, just going like, oh, well, she's in a bad mood today, but she's having her time of the month.
Yeah.
And it's like that type of thing. And I'm actually wondering if there was something else going on to it. Gotcha. All right. So basically if things had gone down the road that they had gone down, she would have gotten the electric chair.
Yes.
And when was it that they commuted that sentence?
1990. Actually, her case went through the appeal process, because every person that's sentenced to death automatically gets put through the appeal process. That's the way the system works. And she was given a lawyer from the ACLU.
Okay.
And so they came back, and by this time, Jack Partain was now the district attorney instead of the assistant district attorney. And so the choice was left up to him as to, did they want to retry, or what did they want to do? And he says, 10 years had passed, he wasn't sure exactly how things would play out through the court system, so they basically came up with a plea deal. They charged her with murder, they charged her with rape, and they charged her with stealing the car. So they were able to give her three life sentences without parole. And that was something I questioned. I was like, how do you charge a female with rape? And basically, they said that if you're in the room and you're allowing the act to take place and you do nothing to stop it, then you can be charged with a crime as well. says.
Interesting.
Yeah, back then, I mean, I was like, okay, how does two women, how does that work? And
yeah,
they gave her three life sentences without the possibility of parole. Well, then, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that you can't sentence a juvenile to life without parole because they don't understand that concept of the rest of their natural life never coming outside of prison walls. And her case fell under that umbrella. It was actually a retroactive deal because she was 17 when she committed the crime.
Right. And you, in our conversations beforehand, you have said that she has gone before the parole board a handful of times and was denied parole all those times,
yeah.
Right?
Yes, yeah. She's had two parole hearings and has been denied both times.
Gotcha. All right. Now, let's kind of jump to the book, Jan, itself. You had written Eula beforehand, which was about was that the first woman that was ever convicted of murder in Georgia, or was this the first woman that was sentenced to the electric chair in Georgia?
The first woman sentenced to the electric chair.
Okay, now did they carry out the sentence on her?
No, and there's a very unusual backstory to that one. So she did not, but both her husband and his friend did, were executed.
Okay, gotcha. All right, and all I can say is stay tuned for that because we will be having Jody back to talk about Eula. Right, Jody?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Okay, that was very Baptist of me. and so, like, when you wrote that book, how did you get involved with even doing this case? Like, what was it that made you go, oh, wow, this would be an interesting story to tell. I can't wait to tell that story. How did you get into that?
It was one of those stories that it happened when I was in 7th or 8th grade. So I had heard about the story, but never all the details. I mean, it's like even now you can say Country Boy Inn and people will talk about that murder, even though the hotel is long gone and the people are long gone.
Right.
It's just a synonymous thing. And I was actually talking to a lady who was our current magistrate judge at the time, and she had been a former GBI agent and worked for the Department of Corrections and things, and she mentioned this case to me, and I was like, oh, well, this will clear up the facts of what I've heard my entire life. And I actually reached out to Janice and said, I'm interested in writing your story. If you'd like to give input, here it is. If not, I'm still going to do it anyway. So it was a pretty drawn-out process. It was probably a month before she replied back to me. And we carried on. We sent letters back and forth for probably about 9 months before I was able to get permission from her warden to see her face-to-face. Because the warden wouldn't let me come in and just do an interview with her. She made me go through the process of getting on her visitation list. So I had to actually come in as a visitor and be in a room full of all of the other visitors who were there for the day.
Right. Now, when you, I got to ask this. First time you get the letter, like you actually see the return address and it says like Pulaski Correctional Center, I think, where she's at. What went through your mind? Because I imagine you're just going down, getting the mail, just going, okay, phone bill, electric bill, more fan letters from Eula book, an opportunity offering me several million dollars for the Eula rights, but I'm changing my mind. And then you see letter, correctional packet, Pulaski Correctional Center. What went through your mind when you see that envelope for the first time?
It's a mixture of nervousness and excitement. It's like, well, is she going to turn me down, or what is she going to tell me, if she's willing to tell me anything? Because you never know what kind of response you're going to get. I mean, I was very open with her when I wrote her, so I was hoping for the same kind of response in return. You know, I was hoping it wasn't going to be a hell no, don't talk to me kind of thing, but, you know.
Right. You would have understood if she just basically said, leave me alone.
I would.
Go away, leave me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only thing she asked me from the very get-go was not to reach out to her daughters, because they had been raised at that point by Danny's family, and she said, I don't want to bring that on them to have to deal with. That's my problems and my issues and not theirs.
Okay, actually, you know what? I did have that in my notes. The obvious question is, how are they doing today? Because they both have got to be in their, both are probably in their 40s right now, and I imagine that wife or their wives, mothers, like any idea on how they're doing, or does Janice not know, or do you not know?
Janice has not seen them, I guess, in 15, 20 years. She actually told me, she said, I have 5 grandchildren I've never seen. And so it was one of those things. I know the oldest daughter has had more issues than the youngest daughter because she was the one that was with them that night.
Oh, gosh, yeah, that can mess up someone.
And so
really.
We don't know exactly how much she remembers or how much she saw or how much was, you know, said to her by other people. But I know that it has caused her, just from what I've read, you know, social media posts, that I don't think she's dealt with that very well. That she's been married several times. She's not really adjusted to that, you know. She never really found a norm, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, the younger daughter was actually adopted by one of Danny's brothers, and they moved out of state for a little while because of his job situation. So she was able to sort of put a little bit of distance in between her and have a little bit more of a normal life. But I haven't really reached out to see, you know, to see how life's turned out, except for what I can glean off that avenue.
Right. Now, in your book, you talk about the first time you met Janice. I want to see, you mentioned, you said about 20 minutes into the visit, that's like when you came in, Janice sees you, gives you a hug, and you're completely at a loss.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm a hugger.
Yeah.
She gives you a hug.
Yeah, and let me sort of give you a picture of that, because she's like 4'11", and at this point she weighs probably about 220 pounds. You know, so she's sort of a healthy little lady. And she walks with this, a little bit of a limp because she's had some health problems. So you see her, and she walks past me first and makes eye contact with me because she has to check in with a guard who happens to be behind me.
Right.
And she comes back up to me, and never has she mentioned in all these letters, you know, anything of that magnitude. And she comes up to probably about chest level on me. And she looks at me and says, I'm a hugger. Can I hug you? And I was like, okay, well, you killed somebody, and this, let me think about it. And you have that
second
to make that decision of, what do I do? If I turn her down, she might not speak to me at all, you know. So I hugged her. It was a very brief hug, but, you know, and then she sat down and started having a conversation.
Right. Now, and the thing was, is that 20 minutes into the conversation, she basically says, okay, we've danced around the elephant in the room enough.
Yeah, and that's exactly, what she said.
Right. Now, my question is, from the hug to when she makes the elephant comment, what did you guys talk about in that time?
It was one of those things where, if you've ever been inside a prison visiting room, which most people haven't, you can get up and get food from them out of the vending machines if you choose to, or they're not allowed to get up out of their seats at all. It's the person that's visiting that can do things for them. They can pick up food or whatever. And so it was basically that chit-chat of, well, I had not bought anything because I didn't know what she was like or if she drank Coke or Pepsi or if she, you know, whatever. So it was just that sort of settling in process of, you know, can I get you a snack? Can I get you a soft drink? Can, you know, and then just sort of,
I was going to say, I would imagine that it would make more sense not to bring anything this first time around and just buy from the concession areas.
Well, you're not allowed to bring anything in from the outside.
Right, I was going to say, like, you know, the classic, you know, like, there's a file baked into the cake type of thing.
And this is the first time we've actually seen each other face-to-face, too. So you're making that connection of, oh, well, this is what you look like, and, you know, now I'm putting a face to a name and that kind of thing.
Right. Now, did you ask her about, like, are you careful with how you talk about what is prison life like? Like, what is your schedule like? What type of job do they give you while you're in there? Like, are you able to, like, could you guys, like, bond over, like, television shows briefly? Like, oh, you mentioned you were watching America's Got Talent. Did you see the episode where they had the guy with the ventriloquist or something like that? Were you able to just talk little things like that in commonality?
Commonality, well, we're close to the same age. We're literally just a couple years apart. So we could relate to things a little bit of things we had seen in the past. And as far as the current, she pretty much self-isolates herself. She goes and does her job, and she comes back to her cell and intermingles. She says, but I don't really watch TV. You know, I'll read books, and I'll do things like that. But she more or less keeps to herself because she got used to that being on death row. And I think it's just sort of a learned behavior of, you know, if you stay out of my business, I'll stay out of your business.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Not to be silly about this, what type of job has she been given in prison?
Actually, she works in the sewing department of the prison, and they make things for outside departments, like for law enforcement agencies and different things like that. It's basically contract work, just like we would have, you know, in another venue,
right,
that they're given contracts to do work with. But, of course, it's done at a fraction of what we would pay for it on the outside.
But, right.
She talks about going to work. She goes to work at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's a really weird thing how they do is they go to work really early in the morning, and then they work till about 2 o'clock, and then they're done. And she takes it very seriously. I mean, to her, that's part of her daily routine. So it gives her something to do to pass the time. It's not just I'm sitting in my cell thinking about, you know, what I've done.
Right. Yeah, because you and I had talked about beforehand that, like, you've got to give somebody a purpose or something, or else that's going to giving them a purpose will just create more animosity and turn them into a harder person to deal with, especially in a prison environment. Yeah, don't get me wrong. Some people come in there with like that. But then, like, just giving them something to do will just make them feel like, hey, I'm accomplishing something, and they can take pride in that, so to speak.
And the hard thing about it was, is when it's like you mentioned, we're talking about the things you have in common, it's almost like her life stopped at 18, because that's when she entered the prison system. And, of course, my life still went on. I mean, I went to college, I had jobs, I did different things. And so you sort of, she still would act like a schoolgirl sometimes, a teenage girl in some of her conversations. You know, she would say something and sort of have that giggle or sort of, you know, be amused by things. And you're thinking, well, you know, you got to admit that's almost where normal life ended. And things we take for granted. And I told you this story that she'd never been to a Walmart store. You know, I'm one of those people, Walmart couple of times a week kind of thing. And she said, well, I've never been in one. And I was like, oh, okay. And you can't physically describe one. So I said, oh, well, I'm just going to take a virtual field trip. And I took some photographs inside of a Walmart store. And I took pictures of the big screen TVs. And it was Christmas time. So I took Christmas trees and this, that, and the other. And I said, I'm back to her. And I'm thinking, well, this way she can see what I'm talking about. And she said, well, some friends and I had a picture party with the picture. She says, we had never been, like three or four of us had never been in a Walmart store. So we were passing the photographs around and picking the things they liked out of it. And she says, you know what I liked the best? And I was like, oh, I have no clue. I thought she'd say something like the TVs or whatever. And she said, no, it was the big cylinder of candy they have back there where the movies are. The Mike and I, Good and Plenty's. And they were 97 cents a box. And she says, they cost us like $1.50 here in prison. So she was really thrilled by the 97-cent box of candy.
Right. Now, can you actually – because, like, I used to work in a bookstore, and one of the rules was I could not take – like, I couldn't – like, if somebody said to me, hey, I'm in jail for drunk driving, I'd love to get a Harry Potter book.
Yeah.
I can't go to the store and buy the Harry Potter book and then go and visit the person. I have to physically go to – say Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and say, hey, I'd like to buy a Harry Potter book and have it sent to this person. Here's his information. Is it that way with other items as well? Like, could you, like, if you had wanted to, could you, like, send her Mike and Ike's? Could you send her cigarettes or something
they're not allowed to smoke anymore, but they actually have care packages that I think it was once every couple of months. But it was like a list of where they could order things and there's actually a company on the outside that caters a lot to prison facilities, and it's a checklist before you can get, you know, crackers, or you can get the little powder like you add into waters, or you can get little packets of instant coffee, or, you know, different things. And I did that a couple of times, just sort of as a gesture of, you know, here it is, you've told me everything about your life, and I can't really send you a, you know, thank you give. So,
right.
You know, I did that, and it was interesting the things that they ask for sometimes that you sort of take for granted of, you know, they mix things together to get a meal. Like when I went to see her, they don't get fresh vegetables. So she was more interested in a salad out of the vending machine than she was a candy bar.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that was sort of an interesting concept of, you know, what they're allowed to have. And it was the same way when I sent the book to her for the first time. I mean, I had to order it through Amazon and have it shipped to her.
Right.
So, you know, you can imagine seeing yourself in print for the first time. And I was actually able to get a copy of the manuscript to her. I think I had to send it to her attorney, and then he was able to do it as sort of a legal paper, you know, somehow or another. She was able to read it and see it, at least for the most part.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean...
Go
ahead.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. There were two things I was going to ask, especially with this. Now, obviously, you and Janice have struck up a... I'm not going to call it a friendship or a relationship,
yeah.
But I'm going to call it a friendly connection. Am I correct on
yeah.
that? Could we say that, like a friendly connection?
Yeah.
When she told you the story, did you have to go back and corroborate, like confirm that what she said was true? Like, did you go back through the evidence, go back through the transcripts and the articles and say, okay, this kind of matches, like what Janice told me matches what's been said before. So you know that she wasn't sitting there going, why, Danny had me tied to the chair and I begged him, no, Danny, please don't do this. And then he stabbed her 97 times and then brought the blade over and put it in my hand. So my fingerprints would be there, type of thing. Did you make sure, like, hey, you know what? I want to make sure that she's not BSing me.
Yeah.
And, like, double-checked everything she said where you could.
Yeah, I pretty much did. I mean, anything that I could corroborate and come back and say, because I had a copy of all the court transcripts and all the legal documents, because once a case has reached its closure and it's gone through all the appeals that it can, those documents then become public records, so you can ask to see
right.
them. And so I had, there was like 3,000 pages, over 3,000 pages.
How was that all?
Yeah. And so I had read everything, and it pretty much matched up. I mean, her story never changed as to admitting what she had done and the whole scenario. So but there was times when she would say things like, you mentioned earlier the story she wrote about, you know, being a born-again Christian and those kind of things, and people said, well, are you sure? Has she changed? Is she sorry? And I said, well, it's not my place to say. I don't know. You know,
right.
And I would tell people that's in between her and, you know, a higher power and not me. And I said that
right.
was the whole purpose of the book, was I'm just putting facts out there, and I try to stay neutral in what I say, is to, that way people can draw their own conclusions. Well, I either agree with what, you know, I think she's guilty or not
right.
guilty or whatever.
Right. Now, what was it that Janice was hoping would be accomplished from this book? Was she hoping, like, did she say one thing one way or the other when she got the book and said, oh, wow, this was great, thank you? Or did she have something in mind with what she had hoped would happen with the book being read? Was it not necessarily, like, more of an understanding? Was she hoping for some sympathy? Did she give any comment one way or the other?
I don't think she had any preconceived ideas of what she expected to happen. Like, I know that she said that she has support groups that she, you know, attends in jail. Like, she goes to Bible studies or for whatever. And she said, yeah,
right.
she says, they did put a copy of my book into the, you know, one of the areas where they meet. And so she's gotten a little bit of notoriety, I guess, from that. I mean, it's not like a, you know, front page news kind of thing to her. It was People know who she is in jail and sort of knows her backstory a little bit. But I think she was okay with the story. She didn't come out and say, "Well, you're a big fat liar," you know. She said, "Well, because I told her to begin with, I said, you do realize that I'm going to have to use the word murder and your name in the same sentence. I said, I can't sugarcoat what I'm going to say, or else it's not going to be truthful." And she said, "Well, I understand. You got to say what you got to say because that's what happened." So
Right, exactly. Yeah, you can't exactly say like, she helped someone along the mortal relieve their mortal coil. You can't say anything like that. You've got to say, because what she did was pretty
yeah.
brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very brutal activity. Gotcha. Now, when you, like, at the end of this, at the end of everything, and you published it and stuff, do you still have contact with her? Do you still, like, write once every couple of months? Does she tell you what's going on?
Probably not that frequently. I mean, it might be several months down the road. I know that for a while, I just sort of had to decompress after it was over with, because this case was very graphic. And so I would write a while and could read documents for a while, and then I would have to walk away for you know, a while and come back. And it was the same way with this. It was like, okay, it's done. I can sort of take a deep breath. But now she's reached out to me the both times that she's had the parole hearings. And, you know, they don't really give them the reasoning for denying their parole. They just said, you know, here's when you can apply again. So, but yeah, it's not like we're still active pen pals. No. But.
Right. It's like, not to be rude about this, was she hoping that you would probably go to bat for her or something and say, like, hey, she's a nice person, go ahead, let her out, like, hoping that you would say that? Do you think that's one of the
reasons? She never asked that. She never, that was never part of the conversation of her expecting me to be her cheerleader. I think it was, you know, if she chose to present that to them, that's fine, but I don't think I could be the one. I mean, I've given several book talks about it, and I really and truly think people have asked me, well, do you think she deserves to be out? And I said, I really don't know. That's not my choice to make.
The chronicler.
Yeah, I'm just the person that told the story, and who knows, you know, depending on what situation she's put in, would life on the outside be a norm?
Yeah. Right. Gotcha. Wow, I gotta tell you, I just looked at the clock. We started talking about 11:20, and it's now 12:40 p.m.
Yeah.
Holy cow. Jody, I have really, really enjoyed our chat today. This is absolutely amazing. My next question for you, obviously, is, yeah, we're holding it over your head that you need to come back to talk about Junior and Eula with us, and if you don't, we understand.
Oh, I love
you
sharing.
Don't have.
I love sharing your story, so you don't have to invite twice. No.
Okay, no, I'm just going the Baptist way. No, that's fine if you don't want to. I understand your life is busy,
yeah.
But don't worry, I'll be dead one day, so you won't have to deal with me. That type of silliness.
And I'll,
no, but,
and I'll bring the traditional Southern casserole, you know, when we come.
or the traditional Southern way of like, F him means, well, bless his heart.
Yes.
So, well, bless Don Smith's heart. So, my question was, what are you doing now? Are you working on a new book, or are you just kind of trying to stay healthy because of COVID-19? Because you also have a pretty active family life as well, and we don't need to go into the details of that, but I know that you're very proud of your family, and I know that you love them very much, because you and I are buddies, and I'm able to see your stuff.
Yeah.
And are you working on anything else? Are you working on it, or are you going to try fiction, or are you going to do another true crime, or what would you be interested in doing?
I love the true crime. That's just the genre I like. And there are a lot of stories to be told in and around where I live. I mean, there's a lot of interesting cases. So I'm weighing some different ideas of what to do next. And people are always calling up and saying, oh, well, you should write about this or that. And I was like, well, are you willing to talk about it? And they're like, oh, well, no, but
yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there'll be another one, but right now I'm just sort of tossing around ideas, and once people say we can go back to normal behavior, then I'll start going back to the courthouse and digging some more.
Right, gotcha. And if people want to get a copy of the book, they can go to your website, which is Jody with a Y, right?
No, with
Jody
an I, with a with an I, J-O-D-I.
That's what I said. I clearly said I. Everybody
yes,
heard me say
did.
I. I didn't
did.
Say Y.
Yeah.
Jody with an I at JodyMcDanielLowry.com, and they can buy copies of the book. But don't worry, we will have links to everything when we publish our interview.
Yes, and you can find them on Amazon, too. And so all three of them are there. You just have to search my name.
Yeah. Yeah, Jody McDaniel Lowry.
Yes,
and it's it, and I got to tell you, one thing, and I didn't say this publicly, but I'm going to say it now. It is a really well-written book. It really is. I really have enjoyed it. And one of the things that that writers of true crime have a really nasty habit of doing is they put themselves into the story more so than they needed to be. And it's kind of one of those things. Obviously, you wrote the book, it became a part of your life, and you do have the right to include yourself, but I ideally think it should always be at the introduction or the afterwards, and then everything in between should be about the event itself. Like, we're not, if you want to write a memoir about the experience, fine, but I'm not interested in reading about the memoir. I'm interested about the crime. Like, I'm not interested that on the day you had to visit her, your husband's favorite shirt got eaten up by the washing machine. I'm more interested about the crime. And you did a very good job of giving enough of your life so that we got to know who you are in the story, in the narrative itself, and we got to see who it is that is chronicling it, and then you stepped back, you were smart enough to step back and let the whole murder itself play, like let the story of the whole murder itself play out. And I got to say that it was a really wonderful narrative, and I really enjoyed reading it.
Well, thank you so much. That's what I try to do, is let the story tell itself.
Yeah, well, that makes a good writer does that, instead of just injecting their opinion in on there and saying, like, boy, it was a real shame she didn't get what she needed.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, you could put that in the afterwards, but beyond that, it's like, who cares?
Yeah.
We just want to know what occurred, and I think you did such a great job, and I see exactly why in the world you're the one giving writers conferences, teaching them, because frankly, you're a very good writer, so
thank
you should be very proud of this book.
Thank you so much.
Everyone, thank you very much for listening, and stay safe out there. As we've said several times in the past, Jody, once again, we want to thank you for being on Conversations of the Strange, and we are looking forward to checking out your other two books and your future books as well. And please know, you always have an open door here.
Well, thank you so much, Don.
So all you have to send me an email going, hey, Don, you know, I want to get a little bit more press. I'm there for you. So, because I really have enjoyed our talk today. And once again, everybody, thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.
Welcome to Conversations of the Strange.
Conversations of the Strange.